The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Jenny Jackson's debut novel, Pineapple Street, was a New York Times bestseller and a Good Morning America Book Club pick. It was named a best book of 2023 by a slew of publications and media outlets, including Time, NPR, Town & Country, Elle, Harper's Bazaar, and the BBC. She is also vice president and executive editor at Alfred A. Knopf. This evening, she'll be joined in conversation with Lexi Bloom, editorial director at Knopf Cooks and senior editor at Alfred A. Knopf. Please welcome Jenny and Lexi to the Free Library.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming.
Hello, everyone. Can you all hear us okay? Excellent. Forgive the glasses. That's the hazard of being a book editor for 20 years. So this is such a great pleasure for me to do this event tonight because I have known Jenny for 20 years. We've worked together for this period of time, and so it is really a thrill and a joy to talk to her about her own best-selling novel. I remember very clearly when Jenny called to tell me that she'd written a novel. It was peak pandemic, and she said, "I have to tell you something." And I thought, "Ooh, it must be office gossip. I miss this. This will be fun." She paused and she said, "Well, I have this interesting novel in to read." And I thought, "That's it? It's just a submission?" And then she paused and she laughed really nervously and said, "No, that's not it. I wrote a novel. Will you read it?" I read it overnight and I was and still am completely in awe of the fact that you wrote not just a novel, but a hilarious, sexy, brilliantly entertaining novel. And also, she did this while the rest of us were just doom-scrolling and freaking out. So, all that said, I wondered if you could talk a little bit about what made you want to write a novel in the first place.
Oh, thank you, Lexi. It really means so much to be talking to you on stage and doing this. Lexi was my first reader and my most trusted early editor because I knew that she would tell me if the book was bad and that I would be embarrassing myself and that I shouldn't do it. It's very important to have a friend who will say, "You're going to embarrass yourself. Don't do this." So, you know, it's funny. I had wanted to be a writer when I was younger, and I studied creative writing in high school and in college, and I thought that that might be, you know, the life for me, but the reality is, you know, I wanted to be able to rent an apartment and to, you know, earn a salary, and I couldn't quite figure out how to do those things. So I thought, okay, maybe I will go to the Columbia Publishing course and I'll get a job in publishing and I'll write on the side. But one of the things they tell you at the Columbia course, and a lot of times in book publishing, is that if you want to be a writer, don't work in publishing. You'll feel like, you know, you're always the bridesmaid, never the bride. You'll feel like all the good stories are already taken. You'll feel like, you know, that you're wasting all your creative energy on other people's stories. And I took that advice to heart. And I think there is a little something to that, because I also think a lot of your creative energy is being poured into the books you're working on, and that's your job. That's, you know, that you're like a midwife for these books. That's what you should be doing. But then a weird thing happened when the pandemic hit. I felt like all of a sudden there were like these little wells of creative energy that were building up, and I didn't have a place to put them. And I was, you know, like all of us, really lonely and frustrated and waking up at 4 a.m. and staring at the ceiling and freaking out and trying to figure out, what do I do with myself to like emotionally get through this? And so I started writing to have people to talk to. I started writing to have people to gossip about. It's like not a coincidence that these characters are always going to parties and dinners and they're flirting and seeing people, because I was just like, please take me away, you know? And so for me, it was very much, it was two things. It was writing this book was a personal way to transport myself to a happier, just more enjoyable place. And then it was also a really interesting realization that the kind of creative energy that for me leads to writing is a kind of creative energy that I had more of when I wasn't going to the office every day, when I wasn't going to book readings all the time, when I wasn't meeting with writers all the time. And I think one of the really interesting things is there's been a lot of conversation over the years about whether you're an introvert or an extrovert, you know, and obviously we all fall, it's a spectrum, we all fall somewhere on it. And the pandemic was really hard for extroverts and hard for introverts in different ways. But it made me realize that in addition to that, like, introvert-extrovert thing, that there's a certain kind of energy, that creative energy, that can be also a social energy, and that I can kind of move that from one place to the other. And so these are, I think, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of writers out here, these are really interesting things for us to learn about ourselves as we try and sort of find our most creative energies, where when during the day we write the best, when we can block out times for ourselves. So that was why, you know, the pandemic was terrible for 9 million reasons, but for one reason, it kind of worked.
We were just talking about this a little bit backstage, but I don't know if everyone in this audience will know sort of when you found time to write. So can you tell people a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I have two small children. They're now 5.5 and 8.5. So during the pandemic, they were 1.5 and 4.5. And so I wrote first thing in the morning from like 4:30 until 7. And then the kids would wake up and I would let them watch cartoons so that I could keep writing for a little while. But then we had Zoom school, I had work, I had to, you know, get into the day. But then again, I found that in the evenings, one of my sort of magic tricks for buying more time was my kids would still take a bath together in the evenings. And so I would put them in a bath and I would fill it with bubbles, dump all the toys possible in there, pour myself a big glass of wine, and then just sit on the closed toilet lid and write while they just like pruned up for hours. They took a lot of really long baths while I was writing that book.
So writers, take note.
Yes. Put your kids in the bath.
It's a good option. I wondered what you were saying about the sort of creative juices and the creative process is very interesting to me. And I wondered if you could talk about, like, what was the germ for this particular story? Like, where did that come from? What was the moment when you thought, this isn't just an idea, this is actually a bigger story that I want to tell?
Yeah, it's funny because I think, so it came from a few different things that were going on. One of them was that, you know, during the pandemic, my husband and I, we live in Brooklyn Heights, and Brooklyn Heights didn't feel safe for the kids. And so we took them to Connecticut to live with my in-laws. And I have amazing in-laws, and they are just, they're good people. They're loving people. I adore them. But for any of you who have spent any amount of time, you know, living with your in-laws, you know, there's just like the funny things that happen when you're living with another family. And like, I always think about this one day where I saw my father-in-law getting ready to boil potatoes, but he was one by one washing them with Ivory soap. And I was like, that is the weirdest thing I have ever seen. And then another day, I looked out the window and they were using a dustbuster and they were dustbusting the trees. And in fairness, there was like a very intense moth infestation at that time. I didn't know that, but I was just like, dude, I have married into a weird family, you know? But it got me thinking about how there are so many things that my husband, who loves my parents, find really weird about our house. Like, at our house, it is considered completely polite to bring a book or a newspaper to breakfast or lunch and not talk to anyone. We all just read at meals, like sometimes at dinner too. And he sits there and he's like, are you guys fighting? Like, why isn't anyone talking to each other? So there is just this reality that even when you marry into a loving family, it's not your family of origin. And so I was thinking a lot about families of origin, about connecting, about the desire to be a part of a group that you just kind of can't be. And then simultaneously, I read this article in the New York Times. It was by this journalist named Zoe Beery. And It's called The Rich Kids Who Want to Tear Down Capitalism, and it's a great read. It's about these socially minded millennial heirs who are set to inherit these vast fortunes that are at odds with their moral values. And so these young people are trying to give away their fortunes, which the family lawyers take exception to. And so it's about both our sort of cultural changing attitudes towards money, and it's also about what money means as a family legacy. And I got to thinking, okay, what would it be like to be a young sort of Gen Z person right now who was rich at a point in our country's history where there are more billionaires than ever, when this generation is set to inherit more money than ever before? But then also, what would it feel like to be a parent and to, you know, have maybe had a lot of great success, or maybe shepherded your family legacy down, and to have your child say, well, everything you're giving me is morally bankrupt and I reject it? And so I was very interested in sort of looking at generational attitudes towards wealth. And so from that sort of sprung the story of Pineapple Street, which is, you know, an outsider moving into a home with her wealthy in-laws and a young woman who is having a moral reckoning over her privilege. So it all just kind of, it all came together from both my real life and my reading life, and snapped into this story.
Who came first, I'm curious, of your characters? Was there one person who sort of appeared for you, or were they all kind of there before you?
I think the stranger comes to town, the old stranger comes to town was what brought me into the book. So Sasha is the character who is sort of the everywoman. She's the one who I, you know, relate to the most. She has a middle-class upbringing, and she marries into this family. And I think she's really one of the things that I find as a book editor, and I wonder if a lot of you find as readers, is that when you're reading a narrative with multiple points of view, you tend to kind of imprint first on the very first character who you meet. And so I always try and be really thoughtful, whether I'm helping someone else with their book or writing my own, to make the first voice the one that's going to kind of carry the reader through the story. And so Sasha came to me first, because Sasha, she's an outsider looking in, and she's able to sort of see the foibles of this ridiculous family, and she's kind of the reader's guide to the strange land of the 1%.
So once you knew you were writing this novel, did you suddenly walk around kind of... Was everything suddenly fodder for this book that you were writing?
Yes, and I was constantly taking notes, and I was constantly making voice memos. And then, you know, my husband, Tori, makes fun of me because he says that we basically had to go on an apology tour once I had written the book, because there were just a lot of stories I stole from friends, from people at my kids' nursery school, from my husband's friends, from his cousins. I was pretty vicious. My husband likes to say that I tickle while I wound, you know? So it's like, it's funny but mean. And so, like, one of my good friends was part of this auction story that's in the book. So they go to a school auction that's kind of over the top, and the stuff that's being auctioned off is, you know, very overpriced. And one of the things is this chair, and, you know, the students have, like, drawn on it with markers, and they're selling it for, like, $1,000. But so in real life, what happened was, you know, it was my daughter's class had drawn on the chair, and my husband and I were like, okay, we'll bid like $80. Oh God, thank goodness somebody else is bidding more. We can back away from this. And, you know, it started going up and up and up. And this woman, Christy, who I didn't know very well at the time, was hugely pregnant. And she sat it and she was like, oh my God, this is the first time my back has stopped hurting for months. I love this chair. And, you know, our friends Rob and Anju were there too. And they were like, oh yeah, we bid on it, but you guys go for it. Absolutely. It's all yours. Christy's like, oh, thank goodness. So up and up and up, like more than $1,000. And then the bidding closes. Rob and Anju hadn't realized that they had ticked the auto bid box to top whatever the final bid was. So when like the auction closed, poor Christy looks at her phone and she's like, oh my God, honey, we didn't get it. And he's like, let me help you up. And she's like, oh, and we're like, this stinks. What kind of jerk took away a chair from a pregnant woman? And then Rob and Anju were like, oh, anyway, we'll see you guys later. So Rob and Anju had accidentally stolen the chair from Christy. So I put it in the book and I changed the names. But then Rob and Anju started actually being good friends with Christy and her husband. And she was like, Jenny, we're hiding this chair in our attic and we're like super ashamed that we stole it. We just like have to tell them that we did. So anyway, it was just like one of many instances of me kind of accidentally blowing up my friend's spots while writing Pineapple Street. But sometimes the truth is funnier than fiction.
Usually is. I'm going to keep that in mind with stories that we share.
Yeah, I'll get permission.
Maybe. In addition to just the kind of general eavesdropping on friends, did you feel like you had to do research to write this book?
I did. So I knew very little about trusts and estates and how wills work and how prenups work and how any of that works. And so I had two friends who are lawyers, and they read it for me. And I tried to keep that part pretty minimal because you'd have to be a better writer than me to make that stuff like juicy fiction. So there's just a little bit of that. But one of the research, so then there were two other parts I did a lot of research on. One was Brooklyn Heights, because Brooklyn Heights is actually an incredibly, incredibly interesting neighborhood. It's known as America's first suburb. It's, you know, just across the river from Manhattan. It's the first subway stop. It's historically preserved. It used to be like a huge area for the Jehovah's Witnesses. That's where they had the watchtower, where they printed the newspapers. It was a place where young Jehovah's would come and live for a year before then going back to their community. So there were all these huge buildings for them to live in. They ate communally. So there were these huge buildings where none of the apartments had kitchens. And then there would be dining halls. And then they had permission from the city to build these tunnels that connected all the Jehovah's buildings all through Brooklyn Heights. When the Jehovah's decided to divest themselves of their Brooklyn Heights property and move upstate, all of a sudden, all of these buildings went up for sale. But it was like all these apartments without kitchens that were like connected to strangers' apartments. So it was this whole crazy thing where they had to fill all the tunnels with cement. And then it actually has changed the neighborhood in a huge way, because it's already an expensive neighborhood to live in. It's like about a third more expensive than the other surrounding neighborhoods. But all of a sudden, there was all this new housing stock. And so these, you know, developers swooped in, turned them into fancy condos. And that's why all of a sudden there are a lot of hedge funders and celebrities living in Brooklyn Heights, which just makes it kind of even weirder to be sort of walking down the street and seeing, you know, Adam Driver, who played Kylo Ren, who's like at the playground with his kid, or Amy Schumer lives there, or James Bond lives. Anyway, it's kind of a wild neighborhood. So I went crazy researching that. And then the last thing that I did a ton of research on that I got a big kick out of was the sort of aviation investment banking part of the book. So there's one character, Darlie, and she is a finance nerd, and she marries this guy, Malcolm. And together, they're both just obsessed with planes, aviation, flying, and more than that, with sort of the business of flying. And this isn't something I knew a ton about. And luckily, one of my good friends is like a very serious av geek. If you're in the know, you're an av geek. And so he read draft after draft for me and really helped me kind of go crazy on making that part of the story totally accurate. And that was fun. It's fun to do the research. I think, you know, you hear of authors who fall in love with their research and put too much of it in there. And I could see how you would want to do that, because it was really fun.
I was just going to ask you a question to that effect, which is, as an editor, when you're working with a writer and you see them go down that rabbit hole, has it changed how you handle that? Or like, do you understand it better? Or do you find that you ask different questions?
I mean, I definitely understand it better, but I also think that it's another kill your darlings situation. I think I now have way more sympathy about, you know, the phrase kill your darlings, where you have to just get rid of something you wrote, even though it's really wonderful, but it doesn't serve the book. I have more sympathy than ever towards Kill Your Darlings. You know, there were jokes in Pineapple Street, and my editor would just be like, yeah, okay, but this joke, I don't think it's funny, so you should take it out. And I would be like, okay. And I would do a draft and like slightly tweak it and be like, she's going to like it now. And then she'd read it again and be like, again, this joke isn't really working, so can you take it out? I was like so offended. I'm like, if you didn't think it was funny, I don't really know why you're publishing this book. But it was really hard for me to kill those darlings. And I think research is similar. You know, you've discovered these things that you find fascinating and you've put them in the book and you're excited to share them with people. But they don't serve the book, and so they have to go. So I get it. I really do. I get how you can just be, you get attached to something, or you like the way it sounds. You know, the rhythms are a weird thing too that I didn't used to be as attuned to. But now sometimes there will be a phrase that I just think it sounds really cool, and I want to keep it for that reason.
Something else I noticed, and I know this about you from talking to you, that you're a great observer of details and, you know, whether it's something that you see or something that someone's wearing or something that you've read, but something that you did so well in the book is like really build out this world of Brooklyn Heights and also interiors, you know, the inside of this house. Did you enjoy that process? And was that something that you sort of knew about yourself as you started to do this in writing? Or was it something that you kind of discovered as the book started to unfold?
I think that the house on Pineapple Street came to mean different things for all the characters. And so, you know, basically it's this limestone mansion on Pineapple Street that the Stockton family has lived in and that the children grew up in. And now the parents have moved out and Cord has moved in with his new wife. And, you know, she has mixed feelings about even being there. She feels like it's full of all this junk that she's not that excited about. Meanwhile, the siblings are so emotionally attached to all the junk or antiques or beautiful things or artwork that's in this house. So they each see the house in different ways. And one of the things that I really enjoy about writing in close person third, when you rotate point of view, is that you get to see the house from each of their points of view, and you get to see what some of them love about the house, what others find, you know, weird or dusty or gross about the house. And so the house was like a chance for me to show how they fit in with the family. I think Tilda, the mother-in-law, is one of my very, very favorite characters. She's outrageous. She's occasionally shallow. She is a bad communicator. And one of her real passions is hosting people, is throwing parties. And the house is very important to her in the way that it looks, because for her, it means something that that sofa came from the governor's mansion. It means something to her that the table is presented in a certain way. And that's because for her, the way that things look is very important.
I always feel like there should be, maybe there is and I don't know it, like a very long German word for books about houses, because they're their own subcategory. It's and true. There's so many great ones. One thing that I also loved, and this is particularly about Tilda, tablescapes.
Tablescapes.
So I didn't even know that was a word or a thing, but now I think about it. Like when we hosted Thanksgiving at my house and I was putting together our Thanksgiving table, and I was like, don't have a nice tablescape. What should I do? Did you have fun kind of playing with that concept?
So much fun. So I had heard the word tablescape because a friend of mine is a designer and actually is really into tablescapes. But I had so much fun making Tilda obsessed with tablescapes because it's just so like ephemeral, you know, like you set a table for a meal and then you clear it all away. Like it's a very short-lived sort of art installation, but it's also an art installation where you get to show off some of your most expensive things, you know? I'm actually, in a funny way, I'm making right now the connection to Kevin Kwan's Crazy Rich Asians, mm-hmm. when the mother has all of her friends over for a jewelry party so they can just lay out all of the jewelry and look at the jewelry. If you came to a jewelry party at my house, it would last 5 minutes and you'd be like, is that from J. Crew? Cool. But I think that like A tablescape is, it's sort of related, right? It's a chance to have people over to look at your expensive china, your wedding china, your expensive stuff. I will tell you one sort of funny tablescape story. So my mother-in-law and I have a wonderful relationship, and she is just like a terrific person. She's also a serious person who, you know, cares passionately about the environment, who reads the newspaper back to front every day, who does not spend more than 1 second thinking about, you know, what she's going to wear or whatever. She's not Tilda at all. But the Hotchkiss Library in Connecticut hosts this fundraiser where they have authors come and people can volunteer to host a dinner party at their home for an author, and people pay for it and raises money for the library. So she very kindly said she would host a dinner for Pineapple Street to raise money for the library. And, you know, she's hosted lots of dinners before and usually, you know, puts flowers on the table, blah, blah, blah. So we walk in and there are like six tables and they all have like a blue tablecloth on it and nothing else. And my husband was like, "Mom, did you want to get like flowers or anything?" And she goes, "No, I don't want anyone to think I'm Tilda." She was going to do the anti-tablescape. She was like, "My tables are going to look like crap. And there's a reason for that."
So you mentioned Kevin Kwan, and I wanted to talk a little bit about, Kevin is one of the amazing writers who Jenny edits, amongst many. As an editor and as your colleague, I am very curious to know how being a writer has affected the way that you do your job. Like, what are some of the things that you now do differently? And what are things that you thought about as a writer, like knowing, letting your editorial role inform that? And now, what are things that you do as an editor, sort of with your writers that you might not have done before?
Yeah, I mean, like, what an exercise in empathy. You know how when people become a doctor, they say, watch one, do one, teach one? Well, I feel like being an editor, I've sort of done it in the wrong order my whole life. I've watched books get edited, then I've told people how to write them, and then last I wrote one myself. So I did it all wrong. And I feel like having written it has given me a lot more empathy. And also, I think I understand structure differently than I used to. In terms of the empathy piece of it, I will say that I have writers who I work with who I love, 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 and who absolutely hate revision. So I work with this amazing, amazing guy. His name's Peter Heller. He wrote The Dog Stars and The Painter, and he's just a magnificent writer. He hates revising. And I'll be like, "Oh my God, Peter, amazing first draft. I think we need another 15,000 words. And he'll be like, "Oh, thanks, Jenny. I'll write five. And I'm like, "Peter, let's like do 10,000 words. And he's like, seven. And he'll come back and do two. And I'm like, "Peter." And I thought that it was because he was just like, you know, on to the next, like ready to move on. He didn't want to be in the book anymore. He wanted to do something else. I've realized it's something else. I've realized it's two things. One of them is that when you're writing, you're really in this kind of creative river and you can hear the voices and you have access to all of them, and scenes can come together, voices come together. It flows. When you're done working on a book and you've stepped out of it for a while, you kind of lose the river and it's really hard to find your way back in. And when I was trying to write new scenes for Pineapple Street, it took me a long time to find the voice again, which seems nuts. Like, I wrote it, it was my voice, but I had a really hard time finding it again. And I think that might be something that happens to people. And then the other really was like, I was just scared that once I started pulling threads, I was going to unravel and break my book. I was like, I feel like it was a balancing act to get a first draft. And I just was scared that I wasn't going to be able to fix it. So I have a lot more sort of empathy for my writers. And I think that makes me want to help them, you know, just with the ones who need it, better, more precise roadmaps for revisions so that they don't feel like, you know, so scared about pulling those threads.
And how you mentioned that it has also made you think differently about structure. How did it make you think differently?
So I have never written a book in first person. I've never written a book with just one character. I was intimidated to do so because, you know, my writer, J. Courtney Sullivan, who wrote Maine and Commencement, she always writes rotating point of view. And Courtney said, jokingly, but also true, rotating point of view is the best, because if you get stuck on someone, just put it down and go work on another one for a while, and then you can come back to it. I found that to be absolutely true. Amazing advice. If I was like not sure how, you know, Darlie was going to react to something, I'd go hang out with Georgiana for a while. You know, it was like really nice to be able to rotate. The thing that I did not understand is that when you write in rotating point of view and then you have to move a plot point. So I had to move Malcolm's, minor spoiler, I had to move Malcolm's firing up to earlier in the book. Oh my God, it changed everything that happened after that. And this person could know this, but not this in this scene. And it was like, probably not trigonometry, but like it felt like it, you know, it was very, very hard to revise. So my opinion now that I will not feel fully justified in giving until I actually try and write one narrator is that it's, for me, I think easier to write rotating point of view, harder to revise, but I think it might be easier to revise in if you write just one narrative strand.
Such a smart point.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's my theory right now. It's a working theory.
Do you have advice for your fellow editors, how to be a little more empathetic to their writers, maybe first-time writers in particular?
Yeah. Okay. So, like, I have a lot. Let me settle in. So one of the things that was funny is I had three editors. So I had an American editor, a UK editor, and I had a Canadian editor. And they're all amazing, amazing, amazing editors, and they gave great notes. And they each wanted to give me notes at the same time. When they gave it to me, the editorial letter was 12 pages long, and it was so overwhelming that I put it in a drawer and couldn't look at it for 2 weeks. It was too much. It was too much for me. And so I think that I do, there are a number of writers who I edit alongside foreign partners. You know, I edit Emily St. John Mandel, and there are three of us that work together on that. Gabrielle Zevin, there are three of us who work together on that. So, you know, a lot of the bigger writers, there are a few of you who work together. And I think that trying to really streamline that so you're not overwhelming the writer off the bat is valuable. I also learned a funny lesson during the bidding process for the book. So one thing that we do in publishing is the agent will often send a manuscript out wide to like a dozen editors or 20 editors. And then the editors who like the project schedule calls to talk to the author. And I've been on the editorial side of hundreds of those, and they kind of work the same way. Like, hey, I love your book. It's so amazing. Best thing I ever read. I think you're a genius. So have you thought about how the ending falls apart? And then, like, you know, you go from there. And when I was doing these calls, I found it so hard. And for me, it was extra awkward because I personally knew all of the editors who I was having these conversations with. And I think they probably thought I had thicker skin, and that also they needed to show that, like, they were going to edit me. It's really hard to have 12 phone calls in a row with people telling you that your ending is stupid. You know, you like, you kind of start to feel bad after a while. And so you don't want to just like pretend on the phone with a writer that you're not going to make them change anything, but it has made me modulate that early conversation to really lean hard on the positives and let them know that while I am excited to work with them and we will do editorial, I am a fan and I'm going to be their ally, you know, mm-hmm. because it's overwhelming for writers to get that much negative feedback all at once.
It's funny because as an editor, not having written a book, you feel like you have to show that you're doing your job.
Yeah, but that's
also
true.
And you want to write the 12-page editorial letter.
That's also true because I did have a conversation with one person who didn't give any feedback. And afterwards I was like, I don't know. I don't think you're going to make the book better, you know, so I didn't pick her.
So you talked about the having to make changes. How different is the final book from your first draft or what you first submitted?
It's definitely a longer book and it's a more layered book. So the first draft that I submitted was 60,000 words and the final is 85,000 words. So it grew by quite a bit. It was funny, I hadn't realized, but Sasha's story in the original draft had a lot of backstory without a whole lot of front story momentum. And so I had to work on increasing that. And I do this really funny thing. So one smart thing that screenwriters often say is they tell you to just like never save anything. Put all your action up front. And one of my bad habits as a writer is I like save my exciting thing. And so like I always knew what was going to happen with Georgiana and the money. And I was like writing happily away. And then I got to like, you know, about 90% of the book and then was like, and now I'll put it in here. And it's like, why did I do that? What? Because then it's like you don't have as much time to explore and enjoy it. So in editorial, I had to move a lot of the like thorny, interesting stuff up to earlier in the book. And that's something that I'm trying to be more mindful of writing something new and trying to start, you know, start with some of that thorny, fun, messy stuff rather than saving so much for late in the book.
I was wondering about your what might seem a vexed relationship between your editing and your writing. And I know that you're a wonderful editor and you give wonderful advice to your novelists. Did you have to put everything away, your persona as an editor, and just let your creative being surge without even thinking about any advice that you would give to you?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I think the weirdest, hardest part for me was actually the sponginess of language and how, you know, when I'm, as an editor, when I'm reading someone's book, I think that one of the things that makes me a good editor is that I can hear the way they think, I can hear the way they talk, I know the words that they use, I know their patterns, and that helps me say, like, hey, I don't think this character would say this right here, or this dialogue doesn't sound like this character. And then I end up when I write copy describing the book, I also try and use that author's, if not voice, their sort of vibe, for lack of a better word. You know, I'm trying to really like get that whole piece and I'm trying to be their mimic. I'm trying to be their parrot, you know? And I think that that's the work of a good editor is I'm not, you know, like Gordon Lish was a famous editor who later, you know, people felt like he kind of put his will onto like Raymond Carver and some of his writers. That's not what I ever want to do. You know, I always want I want to make my writer the most perfect version of themselves. But it means that you inevitably kind of start to, you know, it's like when you go to England and start speaking with a British accent. You just like soak it up a little bit. So I found that to be a really big challenge while I was writing because I would occasionally need to put Pineapple Street to the side and dive into someone else's world for a couple of weeks to edit something. And then I would come out of that world and I'd be like trying to go back into Pineapple Street, but all of a sudden I'd be like still having somebody else's words and language and world in my head a little bit. And so I felt like that was something that I had to be really aware of just to try and kind of like, you know, I joked about like wanting to Windex my brain and just kind of like clean it out a bit in between. But what I really practically meant was taking a little time and then rereading my book from the beginning to get the voice back before going back into it. But that to me was less the inner critic who, you know, she's around, but she's always bothering me. It was more the voice and the sort of catchiness of voices.
Inclusive of soliciting blurbs, were you nervous about your writers reading the book?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It felt really awkward, to be honest. Like, my editors wanted me to ask my writers for quotes, and I felt there's like a huge conflict of interest there, right? Like, I literally pay them. On the other hand, the whole blurb game is so gross and already such a conflict of interest. And I mean, it's so rare for a blurb ever to land just from, you know, just like pure, I read this, I liked this. So I found it very, very awkward. When it came to writers reading it, I didn't feel nervous, but it was funny because I think like I really enjoy working with a wide range of writers, you know, from super literary, maybe like genre sci-fi adjacent all the way to sort of book club fiction, all the way, you know, like a really kind of big range. And so I didn't necessarily think my book was going to be for everybody. And I was really touched, the ones who did read it and talk to me about it. And it was really fun. And it was, but it was also so bizarre too. Like, oh, I read your books, now you read my book. Like, that's so weird, you know? So it was very weird, but I felt so lucky because my writers are awesome, good people. I don't have a single rotten apple in the bunch. And so it turned out to be a great experience, but yeah, I was super nervous.
And I think watching your writers come out for you was so great.
It was really cool.
Think that all of us who know you loved to see this support from all of them.
It's very really nice, exciting. Right? Because I think that it just speaks to their character, because I think that could have felt bad, right?
Mm-hmm.
It could have felt like, you know, like that's not your job. Like, what are you doing? You know, but instead it was really, really
It was just
sweet,
an outpouring
cool.
of love.
It was really nice.
I thought I read that your book was going to be turned into a television show or a movie. Is that the case? And how difficult is that for you?
So it has been optioned for television. And they say the average amount of time for it to get from book to TV show is 5 years. So I'm exercising patience. The writer's strike definitely slowed things down, but now it's back, quote unquote, in development. So we'll see. I mean, I think it requires a lot of letting go. You have a choice, right? Like some people invite you to be a writer on it and to write the script. I've never written a script before. I have a busy day job as a book editor, and I don't know if I know how to write a script. And so I thought that that would probably be like a bad decision on my part. I thought it would be like more likely to be made if I let a professional do it. But with that comes a little bit of like letting go, you know, like what if they make something bad? But right now I'm just trusting the process and hoping for the best.
Do you have a dream cast? Are there people who you're like, if that person played Sasha?
I basically just want Meryl Streep to play all the characters.
I'm curious that you're a very young woman and you went into this field of editing. Were you ever intimidated by a writer that came through the door? Like, how can I possibly, in my station in life, criticize something that this person has written? I just think it would be so scary.
Yes. In fact, even very recently, I edited the last two Cormac McCarthy books. But I felt like I knew, so I did a lot of research and talked to his previous editors before anything, just to say like, all right, what do I absolutely not do? What is a, you know, they're like, do not tell him to start using more commas. I'm like, okay, I'm definitely not gonna do that. So I was aware early on that what, it was very helpful to know what he wanted and didn't want from me. And I think when you're working with a writer of that stature, you just, you're not there to tell them, oh, this character wasn't believable, or, oh, I thought this part was boring. Your job instead turns into something a little more like a continuity editor, you know? And that's what he wanted from me. He wanted me to say, because this is, it was really complicated. There are two books in this series. One is called The Passenger, and one is called Stella Maris. And they were released a month apart, and the books are in dialogue with one another. So one is about the brother, one is about the sister. And the timeline, I won't give too much away, but the timeline's a little funny. But it means that it was very, very hard between the two books to constantly be reconciling what year happened here. What happened to the envelope of cash that you see in this book and then later in this book? So many things to keep track of. Also, he doesn't use a computer. He used a typewriter. And so I never had an electronic file of it. And so when you're doing that kind of like continuity editing and you can't control F find, you're just sitting there like combing through piles and piles of paper trying to be like, I swear there was like a missing violin somewhere in here, you know? So it was really, really hard. also, you know, I suggested things that he didn't like, and he wasn't ever rude about it. He did one time reply, "Oh God, no," to one of my suggestions, but that's fine. I took that in stride.
I hope you framed it.
I did. I saved that one. But one of the other really interesting things was that Hollywood scouts were so obsessed with Cormac McCarthy, and so many amazing movies have been made, that we had to be absolutely cloak and dagger with those manuscripts. So they were never sent electronically. There was a copy in my office, a copy in Sonny's office, and we each had them locked in a drawer so that no one would be able to get to them. And you weren't allowed to ever make a photocopy at the Repro Center. And this is a crazy story, but you know, once a long time ago, Lexi's like getting chills because she remembers this too. When we were, you know, 20 years ago, when we were assistants, one of his manuscripts was sent down to the reproduction center to have copies made in the basement of Penguin Random House. And there was a mole. There was somebody who worked for Hollywood who was at that time in the Repro Center, and they leaked it to Hollywood. That was for No Country for Old Men. And there was hell to pay. So
striking fear in the heart of editorial assistants everywhere.
Exactly. So we really, like, it was stressful on about 45 different levels. It was like, don't offend the master, don't leak it to Hollywood, and try and find the violin on page whatever. It was hard.
Are you going to return to the story, to these characters?
I would really like to, but I want to try and do something else first. The thing that I've been really like gratified by and think is so fun is people want more of Georgiana and Curtis. I think that it's like there's going to be a lot there, and there's not a lot on the page right now. One of the ideas that the film people had were that if they were going to turn it into a multi-season show, every show would focus on the new inhabitants of the limestone, you know? And so the next one would be focused on Darlie's family now that Cord and Sasha are moving off to Red Hook. So I thought that seemed fun. So maybe, but right now I'm working on something that's set in my hometown of Ipswich, Massachusetts. And so it's fun to go back there a little bit.
Well, that is all we have time for. Thank you, Jenny. Thank you all for coming out.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.